Trigger warning. The interview conducted may contain triggering or sensitive materials regarding eating disorders and body image. We're here today with Scott Ellis, author of Chasing Numbers, Starve, Sleep, Repeat. Welcome, Scott. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So, Scott, let's talk about this book. You speak about your journey and battle with anorexia nervosa and your recovery. So when did you start writing down your thoughts, or did you know that you were going to write this book?
I didn't know I was going to write this book, for the longest time. It was something that was quite unexpected. I had shared my story the past summer with quite a few people, and it seemed to make a difference and spark a bit of a conversation. And I realized that conversation really wasn't happening anywhere else. You know, a lot of people don't want to share their story. It's a traumatic experience for themselves. It's deeply personal. So it's quite understanding that there's not a lot of stories out there. But the reality is that, you know, all across the world, all different issues, stories need to be told to make change, to make improvements in our society. So I started not too long ago. It was actually December when I decided to start writing things down. And I had a great team around me, friends and families, and my fiance. She's actually an editor. So that went a long way. And really moving things along. So it only took about half a year to put it together, but I was very happy with it, and I thought it needed to get out there.
And I also think it's interesting because even with eating disorders, like we said, it's not talked about much, but especially with men, like thinking of my friend group and such, I had no idea that males make up 25% of people with anorexia. So did you find that you were able to talk about your eating disorder with your male friends?
Yeah, it's quite interesting because, you know, when you think of an eating disorder, oftentimes society thinks of that, you know, white teenage girl, that's the kind of stereotype of it. When in reality, that's not true. It's, you know, every gender, you know, they're all throughout almost every single culture around the world as well. They affect everyone, no matter their, you know, age as well. We see people as young as 6 having eating disorders, as old as 80 having eating disorders. And for myself, you know, I didn't know I had an eating disorder for the longest time, not until about 7 months into the illness, because I thought, you know, guys don't get eating disorders. I knew there was something clearly wrong, but my mind didn't go to an eating disorder. So it took a long while. And you know, I never knew anyone that had an eating disorder either, so I didn't talk about it at all. And it's kind of actually scary going through that illness, not knowing, you know, what an eating disorder is and having anyone around you, because, you know, in my experience, I was quite ill, and ended up having to go into the hospital. So it definitely affected me not having anyone around me that could be, you know, a mentor, helping me through that experience. And we see it now. There's a lot of guys, like you mentioned, that 25%, you know, there is a lot of guys that have eating disorders, but there's a big stigma around it. And most of those guys aren't sharing it. You know, it's more prevalent. You go to a gym, you know, there's stats out there saying, you know, up to 1 in 10 men going to a gym have an eating disorder, you know, but you probably never know just by looking. You know, you can't tell. And oftentimes men are less likely to share their experience about mental illness. So that's another reason I decided to put it out there, was to hopefully spark a conversation. Hey, say, you know, this doesn't just happen, you know, to women, and those of other genders, it also happens to men.
So what exactly is anorexia nervosa, and like what are its symptoms? What does it look like?
Yeah, so, you know, there's many different types of eating disorders, and anorexia is actually the one people think about the most. You know, when you think of an eating disorder, society's kind of view on it is very thin, which, you know, actually when you're looking at all eating disorders, it's the rarest one. Very few eating disorder cases are actually anorexia nervosa. But anorexia nervosa is usually an obsession with being thin, heavy restriction, underweight, and oftentimes they have symptoms such as, you know, you can't sleep, you have symptoms such as you're cold, your hair is falling out, because your body's not getting the nutrition it needs. So you're basically starving, your body systems. You know, with myself, my heart rate dropped right down. So the lowest my heart rate ever got was 28 at the worst of the illness, which is pretty well, you know, the borderline as low as it goes. So those can be some of the symptoms of anorexia. But oftentimes, a lot of people don't start there. You know, their eating disorder progressively gets worse. And that's why it's so important to catch the symptoms early. And also why it's so hard to tell if someone has anorexia. Oftentimes they can't get treatment or they can't get a diagnosis until they hit that benchmark low weight where they're, you know, have to go into the hospital. So that kind of sums up some of the symptoms of anorexia, but it's definitely an obsession with restriction and often causes very, very low weight in an individual.
Sure.
Can we, in the book, you said the first time you tried a diet was when you were 11 years old.
Yeah.
And I guess you said you found out you had anorexia after. When was the moment that you realized something is wrong here?
Yeah, I had other mental health, you know, issues. I had a depression in high school, and I had been dropping quite a bit of weight. But I didn't really realize it was anorexia nervosa until August. And that was just by, you know, online searching different things, you know, different diets, always checking my weight, always checking my BMI. And I actually had put my weight in one night to check my BMI, and it came up that, you know, you might have anorexia nervosa and, you know, you should seek medical attention. And, you know, of course, at the time I thought it was being a bit dramatic and didn't give it any thought. But then I kind of did a deep dive into it and realized that this was what was happening to me. You know, all the symptoms were there, you know, the obsessive thoughts, the, you know, hair falling out, the low heart rate, low energy. But I never put the two things together. I didn't know it was actually an eating disorder. So it was August, and, you know, I started treatment in October. So it was quite late into the illness. So for a long while, the illness was kind of just running free without even my acknowledgement that it existed.
Are there any initiatives like in schools in terms of curriculums that schools you think should be doing to educate people about eating disorders like this? Are there any initiatives people can take at home for the same?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, school is probably the most important thing where we can make change. You know, when I was in school, I talked a lot about how some of the curriculum wasn't helpful and probably led to the development of an eating disorder. You know, one of my first assignments in grade 9 in gym class was actually tracking calories. So, you know, I had to go home, write down everything I ate, the number of calories, you know, the exact time I exercised per night, you know, which is fine to learn about, you know, what's in food and exercise. But there wasn't focus on the nutritional value of the food. It was all about, you know, how many numbers are going into it. And I always say this, that we were learning to have a relationship with numbers and not food. And it should be the opposite. We should be learning to have a relationship with food, how to grow food, you know, what food can make us do, how it can, you know, keep us healthy, and it can do all these amazing things for us. So, you know, my schooling, there was you know, a lot of issues, and some of those are changing. They're teaching more about the nutritional value now, but there's a long way to go, and there's a lot of stigmas in the education as well, about, you know, weight and fat as well, and it's all about, you know, being this certain weight, this textbook number, when in reality, you know, for a 14-year-old that's growing and changing, that's not really needed, nor is it helpful. And, you know, I think of me as a guy, you know, those of another gender, women, they have much more pressure than I have. And I can't imagine, you know, a 14-year-old girl going home and having to track everything that they're putting in their body at that particular age where everyone is growing. So it can be really detrimental. And, you know, I think what we can do to change things is just having a positive conversation around food and not looking at it as some, you know, limit, you know, not going through the day and thinking, you know, this is my set amount of food. You know, eat what makes you feel good. And if you're hungry, you know, eat. It's not, you know, once I get to this limit. And parents have a, you know, a big role in this too. You know, you think about, you take a lot from your parents every single day. True. You take so much from your parents.
Did you grow up in diet culture? Is that why you started at 11?
I mean, a bit, but you know, I think everyone grows up in diet culture, especially in North America. You know, if you go to a grocery store, you can go to one tonight and it's all around you. You go to the front to check out. You can't get away from the magazines covered with diets on the front, the television ads. I'm sure if, you know, you're online, you see ads pop up everywhere about, you know, the newest diet. And I think it affects everyone. People are just so submerged in this culture, and that needs a big change. And you know, sometimes we're spreading this narrative and culture without even realizing it. You know, at school, workplaces, there's so much talk about diet, whereas that's not necessarily helpful. I mentioned one time in the book, you know, when I was in college, I was at lunch with friends, and someone said they were trying this diet, and they had to get through the day, and they were skipping a meal, and you know, someone encouraged, you know, you can do it. You're like, you're almost there. The day's almost over. That's, you know, not helpful. And even like parents, you know, you think about lots of parents who are on diets, and you have, you know, people saying, oh, I can't eat anymore because I'm at my limit. What if a 7-year-old is listening to that conversation? Like, their brain is developing, so when they're growing up, they think that's the way they're supposed to think about food. You know, I reach this limit, I gotta stop. Or no, I should skip a meal because I ate too much earlier. It's kind of like the stats around smoking. You know, if parents smoke, there's a very high chance that, you know, the child will be a smoker as well. It's the same thing with dieting and these disordered eating habits. If they're practicing them, you know, your kids are going to practice them when they go to school.
And in addition to school and at home, let's talk about today's world. Is there a link between social media and eating disorders? And how does social media drive eating disorders, if there is a link?
Yeah, that's a huge one. There's definitely a link. It's definitely added a lot more pressure. And, you know, social media, you see all these pictures every single day. And oftentimes, you know, we're not always putting the best images out there. You know, there's a lot of diets going out there. There's a lot of people promoting habits that maybe aren't the best for one's well-being. And we often forget who's seeing these images. You know, when we look at social media, it's not just adults anymore. You know, 7-year-olds, 8-year-olds, 9-year-olds have phones and tablets. Like, they're so immersed with technology now that they're the ones seeing all these things. And that's where it's really dangerous, because, you know, an adult can look at something and usually, you know, right, see kind of the bias minute. But, you know, an 8-year-old seeing, you know, a picture of someone that's saying, oh, you know, try this new diet, you know, that's not helpful for them. You know, that's the way they're going to think. And they see these images of also people that, you know, have these unattainable bodies on magazine covers and think that, you know, I have to be like that. When in truth, it's distorting reality. And it can be very harmful for them going through school when they need to be eating to learn and develop. And they're not. So social media is a huge driver. And that's why it's so important that, you know, parents need to be looking at what their, you know, kids are seeing on social media, but even ourselves and even myself, you know, when on social media, following people that aren't pushing, you know, harmful diets and things that aren't going to be helpful for your well-being, making sure you know, clean your social media feed and making sure that the people you're following have your best interests in mind. Because, you know, there's a lot of money behind all these diet products, and I'm sure all of us here today, or, you know, in the past week, have seen someone promoting some, you know, diet or wellness.
Or tea, lots of fit teas going around.
Yeah, exactly. That, you know, aren't necessarily good for you or going to help you in the long
run. And not to mention, a lot of these photos, like, that we see on social media and magazines, heavily airbrushed, makeup, and a whole team behind them.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And
exactly. It's distorted reality. Yeah.
We should mention, just as before we wrap up, that all proceeds from Chasing Numbers will be donated to Eating Disorders Nova Scotia.
Yeah, they'll all be donated. So well over $1,000 has been donated so far. I think we're around $1,500-$1,600. So it's been quite, it's been really good. And hopefully lots more goes, because they run a lot of good programs. And, you know, I'll mention that, you know, all their programs are available to anyone in Nova Scotia with OTA referral or diagnosis. So if you don't hit that, you know, benchmark weight they put out there, you can actually get the support you need before it gets, you know, to a critical point.
So, Scott, I know you talk about this in your book, but can you share with us a little bit about your recovery journey? How did it begin and what were some of the challenges?
Yeah, so, you know, recovery really began at the breaking point for me. You know, when I realized I had a problem and that, you know, things weren't going well. My heart rate was, you know, at 28. My hair.
When was this?
This was in October of 2016. Yeah, so, you know, the symptoms were getting worse. Hair was falling out. I could barely walk. I was fainting, and I was down to about 150 calories a day. So it was quite low, and that was for over a week.
That's equivalent to 3 apples?
Yeah, it was very low. And, you know, I went 6 days and then I hit a breaking point and had a binge where, you know, I went to end up going to McDonald's and eating probably about 5,000 calories in about 20 minutes. And, you know, that really affected me. You know, when I ate that, my heart, you know, didn't like it. It jumped up, you know, well up to 190 beats per minute, and I was having severe chest pains. And, you know, I realized that I'm probably going to die if I don't go to the hospital. So the next morning, I decided to go in. And as it turns out, within about 10 minutes, they were pretty, pretty quick diagnosis that I had anorexia, and they said I need to transfer to the IWK immediately. So I went to the IWK, the Garen Mental Health Center, the next day to begin my recovery. And pretty reluctantly, you know, I was under the idea that I would go in, get the diagnosis, kind of like, you know, shock my mind and saying, okay, I need to do something. But, you know, it didn't turn out that way. I actually had to stay in the hospital, unsurprisingly to most people, and, you know, started my recovery. And it was, you know, a slow process. It, you know, wasn't me going to the hospital and getting fixed. A lot of people think, you know, as soon as they're eating food, that they're recovered. When in reality, eating food's probably the easiest part of recovery. You know, you can go into the hospital and eat a meal, but it doesn't mean the psychological side is gone. And that's what a lot of people forget about eating disorders. They often say, oh, you can just be recovered by eating more. Or, you know, a parent might just say, oh, just eat a little bit more. But in reality, it's, you know, a brain disease, and actually changes the structure of your brain when you have it. So it took a long time from that original hospital stay. I was released about 2 weeks later. You know, because I didn't want to be there. Against medical advice, they told me to stay, but I ended up leaving. And, you know, the day I got out, I dropped right back down on with calories. It not as low as I was, but I dropped enough that I could keep myself alive, but also that I wouldn't gain weight. So I was kind of in a bit of a stalemate with my illness. And, you know, as the weeks went on, I really worked at trying to rewire my thoughts around food as I slowly started increasing my intake. And doing that for about 2 years, it was a battle kind of back and forth. You know, I'd have really good days and really bad days. And I always say, you know, recovery is not, you know,
a straight line.
Yeah, it's, you know, back and forth constantly. You know, I have good weeks and then I'll have a bad week. But as time went on, there was more good days than bad days, and that's how I knew I was making progress. And I was very lucky I didn't have a relapse, because a lot of people do. It's a very, very high chance, and most people, you know, never truly recover. You know, 80% of people with anorexia never actually recover. And you know, recovery is something that, you know, there's no real definition to it. It's what does recovery mean to you? And recovery to me meant that, you know, I could go out and, you know, at a restaurant and I wouldn't be looking at the menu for 4 hours before, and, you know, counting calories, and my mind would be free because, you know, my mind was consumed before. And that's how I knew I was recovered. And, you know, to this day, it's not perfect. You know, I don't restrict anymore, and those thoughts don't turn into actions. But there are, of course, days there's thoughts there, and you know, everyone has those thoughts. And that kind of goes back to, we're surrounded by a culture. It's very hard to move away from a culture when you're submerged in it. So, you know, it was a long path to recovery, but you know, I consider myself fully recovered, and you know, recovery is different for every single person, and it never looks the same.